You are listening to WRAR 97.3 LPFM, and this is Open Source RVA. On today's episode of Open Source RVA, we'll talk with CBS News 6 reporter Katie Beck about the controversy surrounding Richmond's Department of Social Services. We'll also speak with Bill Martin, the director of the Valentine History Center, about the Valentine's latest project, History Inc., that documents Richmond's thriving tattoo culture. But first, here's some of the top stories making headlines right now. Richmond comes in at an unlucky number 7 in gun-related deaths among major U.S. metropolitan areas and cities, at least according to data culled from Center for Disease Control and Prevention findings and analyzed by Richard Florida and his Martin Prosperity Institute colleagues. This number includes gun-related suicides and homicides and represents gun-related deaths per 100,000 people. Richmond City sees 29.9 gun deaths for every 100,000 Richmonders, though the rate drops to just over half of that in the surrounding metro area, only 15.7 gun deaths per 100,000. Going by gun homicides only, Richmond stays in the top 10 at number 8. 23.1 out of 100,000 Richmond City residents were killed by firearm during the years the information was collected. As for gun suicides, Richmond was not in the top 10, though closely trailing. Some factors that seem to be associated with gun deaths in popular imagination, specifically mental illness, stress levels, and drug use, were not found to have any notable relation by these numbers. The clearest correlations turned out to be between gun violence and what Richard Florida named as key markers of socioeconomic disadvantage, poverty, income, education, class, and race. A few weeks ago, Open Source RVA spoke with Mo Karn of the Wingnut Anarchist Collective, as well as a man going under the name John Q. Public. This week, reporter Chris Dovey sat down with Karn's lawyer to discuss further developments of their story.
All right. I'm with Andrew T. Boda, and he is a lawyer with the firm of Thomas H. Roberts and Associates. Now, the organization that Ms. Karn is with published something on their Facebook page yesterday that was essentially a plea to the public looking for whoever has the jump drive, asking them to return it by a certain date. Can you explain that?
Well, there's essentially several concerns here. The suit in this case has 10 unidentified defendants. There are 10 people they identify as Doe 1 through 10 that are being sued in this case, and we don't know who they are. They have not been identified, and the Richmond Police Department apparently doesn't know who they are. So anybody of the public can be added into this lawsuit through in the future. And at this point, our clients are exercising their right to remain silent concerning what they know about this information because the Richmond Police Department has seen fit to suggest that this is somehow obstruction of justice or a violation of the Virginia Computer Crimes Act to publish this information online. For that reason, we suggested to our clients that they ask the public to turn over this hard drive to the court since the one part of the injunction requires any of the defendants to turn this flash drive or this portable hard drive over to the court.
If that individual is not named specifically, does the injunction still apply to whoever that individual?
Well, it may not apply to those individuals, but that raises a special concern for our clients because as long as our clients are the prime two defendants in this action, then somebody submitting this flash drive to the court may well be used as evidence that our clients were the ones who had this flash drive all along. And hopefully by publicizing the fact that this injunction is out there and our clients are subject to this this requirement, it will help dispel the notion that they were the only two people that could have possibly turned in this flash drive or this portable hard drive if it is indeed out there or available yet.
Efforts were made prior to this broadcast to contact Richmond police officials. Multiple emails and telephone calls were not returned.
Billed as Richmond's first and worst variety show, The two-night Hamaganza 2012 begins this evening with a packed show at Hardywood Brewery. The annual charity benefit features local politicians, media personalities, and even some actual musicians as they seek to entertain you with bad cover songs, shocking performances, and a whole lot of bawdy joking about. The cost of attending Hamaganza is a ham, or $10, that will help to feed the needy this holiday season. All food collected will go to Feed More, a coalition of organizations who help to fight hunger in Central Virginia. Organized by our own Chris Dovey, Hamaganza has become an annual holiday tradition, whether you like it or not. Performers will reportedly include City Councilman Marty Jewell, the Lady Arm Wrestlers of Raffle, juggler Jonathan Austin, WRIC anchorman Juan Condi, school board members Kim Gray and Jeff Bourne, and of course, Dirt Woman. The ham slinging continues tomorrow night at Lulu's in Chaco Bottom, and more information on the big show can be found on the Hamaganza Facebook page.
Betty Lou got a new tattoo. Betty Lou got a new tattoo.
There's one fact you can't wipe away. Richmond loves its tats. In a recent survey, Richmond was the third most tattooed city in the U.S. The city averages more than 14 tattooing parlors per 100,000 people, and the counties also have their share. A new exhibition at the Valentine Richmond History Center called History, Inc., the Tattoo Archive Project, documents the art of indigenous body painting and charts how a unique once-taboo practice has become an indelible part of Richmond's cultural identity. I'm pleased to have the Valentine's director, Bill Martin, with me to talk about the project and to also speak about some of the changes that are coming up at the Valentine, which has been collecting, preserving, and showcasing Richmond's past for more than 100 years. Welcome back, Bill.
It's great to be here.
I guess I should note that this conversation about tattoos is being had by two guys without tattoos.
It is. I'm sorry. You know, let's go now.
But it's okay.
Same block. We can go.
Yeah, it's okay because our producer and today's engineer, Gabby Schatzi, has more than enough for all of us. Thank you, Gabby. Appreciate that. Bill, the Valentine, the venerable protector of Richmond artifacts, papers, furniture, and historic houses and everything else, tattoos?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that that's one of the, our real question for us is what who is a Richmonder?
Mm-hmm.
And what does a Richmonder look like? And how do we document that? And so, in fact, doing tattoos fits in with our huge photography collection, with all the other collections that we have that document the life of all Richmonders.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting way for us to connect with new audiences, but it also really builds our photography collection. There are over a million photographs
right.
in the photography collection. So this just really builds on an existing collection. And it also gives us these wonderful stories.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, history for us are not dates and the famous, but are these amazing stories and how people connect to the city and to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so the tattoos are actually an opportunity for us to really record these beautiful stories about the relationship between people and why they put mm-hmm. ink on their body, of the relationship between the tattoo artist and the subject. I mean, it's just sort of
right.
this interesting
And also
thing.
Some beautiful art.
And they are beautiful. And yes, certainly this is not an art exhibition, so it was curated in a very different way than if it had been, say, at the VMFA.
Mm-hmm.
We were really looking at documenting Richmond tattoo artists. We also gave preference to tattoos that were of Richmond themes and subjects.
Right.
So it was interesting to see that what people identified and self-identified that
mm-hmm.
to come in on a Sunday afternoon, Sunday morning, and have a photograph made.
Right. Well, how did this project come about? What was the original impetus for this? Was it the survey that the Today Show took?
Do you really like the story is really fascinating. 15 years ago, one of my board members went to the Victoria and Albert in London, and they had free tattoo day. If you would let them photograph your tattoo, you could get into the V&A for free.
Hmm.
And he came back, and this was 15 years ago, and said, Bill, we really need to do this. And I'm going, you are crazy. You know, that's not what we do.
Mm-hmm.
That's not necessarily. And then suddenly we see this really emerging as an important cultural trend. Wasn't really, I mean, if you thought 15 years ago, that probably wasn't something you'd see a lot of in Richmond.
No.
But
kind of startling now, actually.
It's not. But I mean, and so here we are, third most tattooed city in the country, and that requires some documentation. And so we working with a couple local publications and a lot of social media, really we're able to recruit and ask the community to come and share their tattoos with us. And so I'll just tell you, we found the most amazing photographer, Terry Brown, who works with Gordon Stettinius at Candela Gallery down on Broad Street. Amazing photographer who worked over the summer with us, really working individually with these folks to get that experience down.
And you're going to have an online exhibit of some of the photos soon, right?
Absolutely. It's online now, and you can begin to add your own photographs.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So ordinary citizens can be a part of this.
Absolutely. Everyone. The web stuff will not be curated, so it's whatever you want.
Oh, wow. Well, talk about what you learned about this culture, this tattoo culture that you didn't know when you went into this.
Well, I think a couple things. The relationship between the tattoo artist and the person getting the tattoo. There's this really, it is an intimacy, I think, that develops. And what you see is someone who gets one tattoo, suddenly there is the second and the third. Mm-hmm. Because there is this relationship, I think, and between the experience of getting the tattoo. It's more about the experience of getting the tattoo and the relationship with this beautiful thing and pain, because it's not without pain.
Right, right.
And so you've got this odd combination of things going on between the artist and the person. Mm-hmm. That is the thing that fascinated me the most. And everyone that came in talked about the reason, why did you do it? And it was, there were mixed reasons, but once there was that first tattoo, the relationship was established. And that was for me the most fascinating. And these were very personal and intimate moments.
Right.
That I think were, and from an Amy Black, who's a great artist in town, who, with many women who are having reconstructive surgery, you know, she helps those women sort of recreate their appearance.
Mm-hmm.
And reestablishes, you know, their bodies. And right. I think that's really an exciting thing that I really totally foreign to me. I'm at the Valentine. You know, it's not what we do necessarily.
Right, it is new territory.
But it isn't. But it is and it isn't, because we are dedicated to broadening that story. And so whether it's in our collections, it's in the kind of exhibitions that we do, and I think you'll see as we move into our next phase of development, a lot more of these civic engagement, community engagement kinds of activities that allow us to be a part of the conversation, to help inform a conversation that maybe we wouldn't have done in the past or didn't have the resources to do in the past.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, who else did you work with on the project? Some other tattoo artists?
Tattoo artists all over town. And it was fun seeing that at the other great learning, and I'm not sure the language to describe it. There are what I would call the old school tattoo artists, those that have been in the business for a number of years, that came to Richmond when it was a dirty business, that it wasn't a reputable business,
right.
And who have held up their art for all of these years, to be confronted with this group of young tattoo artists.
Right.
Who really see this as their form. And that was probably the other thing that I learned from this, is this interesting tension in many ways.
Because you have a new generation coming up.
A new generation who approach the art very differently than this group who have been in this business and in this art for a much longer time.
And you had both schools kind of working.
And we have both schools represented in the exhibition, which is, again, important because we wanted to make sure that we represented fairly and across all the disciplines and all the people. It's fun.
Well, some of the tattoo photos I've seen are just absolutely lovely, and some of them are really striking and very.
The colors are strong and amazing. But some artists do this very strong color, but there are others like a Theoduskin who does these very delicate light.
From Ghost Print.
Ghost Print, yeah. really just these beautiful things that are very light, that sort of float on the body in many ways. So we've got this really interesting contrast in styles that are represented in the exhibition, too.
What do you think what does the popularity of tattooing say about us, Richmonders, as far as our culture? What do you think that says about us, that we've embraced it as much as we have?
I think because it really reflects the growth of the arts in Richmond, that in fact, if you look at the connections between artists, the art school, and other communities where tattoos have become very popular, you see this emergence of an arts culture that really moves beyond the mainstream and is really reflective of this underground art scene that really is part of Richmond. And and when we say, what does a Richmonder look like? It looks like someone from the West End. It looks like someone from Church Hill, but it also looks like someone who is living, you know, in Oregon Hill. I mean, it's just sort of wherever, where, and so what do people look like? And this is sort of a new Richmond profile that is part of who we are.
If people listening wanted to send in their tattoos, where would they send them?
The best way would be go to our website, and I think you can click through there.
Okay, and that's RichmondHistoryCenter.com?
RichmondHistoryCenter.com.
Great. Well, you were also telling me about another exciting exhibit that's coming up. I don't know when it's starting, but it's a History of Richmond in 50 Objects. This sounds interesting.
It's a challenge. We have a new curator, and in the first few weeks that he was there, we're going, well, you know, we have an exhibition that's opening. It's going to be the last exhibition, big exhibition that we do before we begin our construction, which means it will be sort of closed sometime next fall.
Right, I want to ask you about that too.
So this needs to be something that will ask the question, what do we have in the collection? What are the main themes that we want to address as we go forward in new exhibitions?
Now I have to stop here and say, you gave me a tour of some of your archives, just some of them one time, and I was overwhelmed by what I was tripping on George Washington's cane at one point.
Well, you weren't tripping on it. Please don't say that. There are 1.6 million objects in this collection. And so what inspired this is there have been a number of couple other projects around the world. Again, in London, there was a project, History of the World, from the British, at the British Museum. History of the World in 100 objects.
Right, right.
Okay, so if they can do the History of the World in 100.
Yeah.
The New York Times did History of New York in 50, and so this is like 6 months ago. And that really became this challenge to carefully go into the collection and begin to find the things that talk about pivot points. Some of these are not glamorous objects. Some of them are not objects that you would expect.
No, but they tell part of the story.
But they tell the part of the story. So suddenly there's a TV.
You're right. Okay.
The 1950s.
But not just any TV, right?
It is any TV because everyone had a TV.
Oh, right? Gotcha. Okay.
So it's a Philco TV, I think, from the late 1950s.
Right.
Would have been appearing in Richmond's living rooms. What impacted television and this sort of broader connection to the outside world, immediate connection to the outside world, mean and how did it change Richmond's connection to other places? And did it, in fact, move other activity? Do we find the civil rights moving out of this, moving forward, because there's this sudden instant communication we suddenly all know and can see it on the ground? So what impact do things like TV and other media have on us? So there's a Victrola.
Yeah, name a couple of other.
Well, I think it's from the very beginning, and picking 18th century objects there, I will say that we posted the list today and at one of our meetings, and I'm like, well, what about this? And all the things that were mentioned were all things that were 20th century. And we're like, guys, there's some other history here, and we need to make sure that it's all reflected, and so how do you balance it out? And so the curator's actually been very careful about saying X number of objects for the 18th, X number of objects for the 19th, X number of objects for the 20th. And so there is this more looking back that I think the history's deeper and longer than most people looking at.
Plus, you get to show off the things that are in your archive.
Right, exactly. And there are things that will be in this exhibition that probably haven't been exhibited for a very long time or never exhibited. One of the things that will be in the exhibition that's a very powerful object is a flogger that was associated with Richmond's slave trade.
And it's never been exhibited before.
It's been exhibited maybe once. It appeared in a catalog back in the 1950s, and I think we did have it recently exhibited, but it's not been in the kind of format that you will see here. Great paintings from the collection, so it's you know, Patrick Henry's, there's Patrick Henry material. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's Thomas Jefferson and a lot of others. But I think just kind of moving up. But there's also Thomas Bouchal. Do you know who Thomas Bouchal
is? Who is Thomas Bouchal?
Well, there's Bouchal School. Mm-hmm. But Bouchal is an interesting, he was head of one of our local banks, and really introduced something called the Morris Plan. And the Morris Plan, we assume with our credit cards in our pocket today that banks have always issued credit cards. And before...
Right, they're commonplace now.
They're commonplace now. But until World War II, really, before that, everyone had store issued. So you'd have your Tallheimer's card and your Miller and Rhodes card. So wouldn't it be easier to have one card and issue and have the bank process all those transactions? That really was something that was pioneered in Richmond. And Thomas Bouchal was the person who really was pushing that consumer credit in the 1950s. And so really an important figure, not only in Richmond finance, but in American finance.
So you may have one of those cards.
We have one of those cards, but we also have this amazing portrait of Thomas Bouchal. So Thomas Bouchal is going to be in the exhibition. In fact, we were having that conversation today. Would it be more effective to have
the card
or the portrait? We're going for the portrait because it's a wonderful new gift to the Valentine. So that also speaks to we're continuing to collect and adding things. So
now that exhibit will run.
Well, it opens. Okay, we're getting a little hokey, and I can't. I'm going to
get hokey. Come on.
I'm going to apologize now. It's opening on February the 14th. On Valentine's Day, what else should you do at the Valentine?
Oh, my gosh. Then go down with your loved one.
Go down with your loved one. Cheap date.
Oh, my gosh. Cheap date, but so much history.
So much history. And and what we hope there, again, is each thing that you'll see us doing going forward, there will be a social media component and a component that will attempt to engage people in the exhibition.
Yeah, so, you mentioned something about participation.
We need people to help us. We need people to take this list of 50, come see them, and then the most important part of it, actually, is for people to let us know what's missing.
Yeah, I love that.
You know, it's always...
I'm sure you won't hear from anyone.
I'm already hearing from staff and trustees. So, and the list has not gone beyond our group. So I can't wait. I mean, I really can't wait because that's the excitement. Mm-hmm. That's the dialogue.
Richmonders love to debate history.
They love to debate history. There are a couple people outside of the institution who have seen it and they've liked it so far. Harry Collins has looked at the list and he thinks it's okay. So.
Oh, okay. Well, then we're all right then.
We're all right. we're absolutely all right. But it is. It's not your normal objects. It's not your normal history. And we think that for instance, the first Mexican restaurant in Richmond, we have the sign from the restaurant and the menus.
How far are we dating back here?
Not far.
Okay.
Not far. But, you know, what was it like to have your first taco? Out in a restaurant? And right. So we have the menu and we have the table and have the sign. Something from that restaurant will be in the exhibition.
Right, right.
We also are documenting more recent immigrants to the city. So there's an object, I think from China, but certainly an Asian object. And then one of the most recent objects that have been added to the collection is that we did receive from the Fed the pride flag that became the center of controversy a couple years ago. And so we were able to negotiate with...
So it's not just objects from the archive, but you've also gone out to find...
Well, this was something that was that's just been added in the last 2 years that are part of the continuing... We did not collect it for the exhibition, but
you had it.
But we had it, and seems like this logical point to talk about this change again.
Yeah.
Who is Richmond? I don't get it. What are we? Mm-hmm. And as an institution, we need to be pushing people and pushing ourselves mm-hmm. and the scholarship to say, who have we been?
Right.
This is what we've said we've been. How is it different? What are we becoming as a city? And are there points in our past? Are there points in the past that can help us really inform what we really want to become? That sounds very, you know, but it is. In fact, at the core of what—
Yeah, it's a living history.
Yeah, well, it's at the core of what we do mm-hmm. is this conversation with right. the past.
Right. Well, you've also got some other big changes afoot. You mentioned the the Valentine is going to be closed at the end of next year?
Next year. Not yet.
End of next year.
How
long and for what reason?
We think that about 6 months, could be a little bit longer, but sometime mid-October through spring, summer of the following year. Really exciting. Over the last 10 years, we've been gradually working our way through all of our buildings, and so the studio was restored in the garden. The Davis House on the corner, small house that we've owned for a number of years, restored. And then roof. I know this is not glamorous, but new roofs and new heating and air conditioning mm-hmm. and all those things. And so now we have this last project, this last piece, which takes every single one of our public spaces, from gift shop to galleries, education spaces, mm-hmm. and strips them out, and we start over.
Oh, wow. Well, I was going to ask if the library would be open in any way to
We're going
help.
To try to keep everything open. As you know, we've transitioned a lot of our programs to off-site. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, the majority of the people that we now serve are people that are off-site. We'll have record attendance this year with our walking tours that go everywhere. We'll have record attendance this year with a new program. Of course, we'll have records. It's new. Mm-hmm. But with senior connections that take history into... sites, 22 sites around the city where seniors gather for social activities. We're doing programming in all 22 sites, so that much of our programming is now off-site. So we're hoping that we're engaged enough in the city.
Yeah, that you can weather this.
That we can weather 6 months mm-hmm. Of being closed. But we're not sure yet. We're still working with contractors on what piece will happen when. And so it's going to be this interesting balance between that. But it's going to transform us mm-hmm. because suddenly
you I was going to say, what exactly are you?
Well, one, there'll be a small, smaller exhibition that is a core history of the city. So this is our view of the city today, mm-hmm. not chronological, but based on themes that are important to us, to the city today. It's, you know, who has power? What do we believe? What do we think about our future? Where do we live? Where do we work? Mm-hmm. So it'll be focused around these bigger themes rather than a pure chronological history. The other piece is a set of new galleries that are at this point called the community galleries. That'll be quick, every 6 months or so, an exhibition that really helps address a current topic. So, for instance, mm-hmm. today we would be doing Where Do You Play Baseball?
Oh, okay.
And we can actually, from our collection, tell you where baseball mm-hmm. has been played.
Right. Well, That's quite a history,
and one that might be able to give us some hints on where we ought to play baseball today. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Hey.
Don't know. Or food deserts. You know, where Richmonders, we saw a great exhibition at the Museum of the City of New York a few years ago that looks at nutrition and how people have access to fresh food. And so we can do an exhibition, photographs of how people from markets mm-hmm. and grocery stores to big box retail today. And how do we look at neighborhoods that don't have access to fresh food today?
Right.
And working with groups like Tricycle Gardens and other groups to mm-hmm. really think of help craft a conversation. So those are galleries. And then downstairs, new education center. We do 25,000 kids a year. Mm-hmm. Which is pretty crazy, and we have this great costume and textile collection, so there'll be new galleries really dedicated to the costume and textile collection. So
wow.
it's
so this has been in the works for quite a while. This
a really, just, yeah. really long time. We always do, we are these incredibly frugal about these things, and so we only do the project when we have the money, mm-hmm. and we do them in small pieces. So it's let's do the heating and air conditioning and the roof and a new terrace. It's sort of a new entrance.
Right.
Let's do this building. So we take this off in basically $4 to $5 million chunks, which is big chunks for us, and are able to do them, celebrate success, and then move on. But in each one of those campaigns, what we want to be able to do is provide these services for free or for lower costs.
Right.
And to do that requires building an endowment. Mm-hmm. And so at each piece along the way, for almost dollar for dollar, every dollar we spend on a building, we also spend on the future by building endowment. Because it doesn't matter if you have a beautiful...
I was going to ask, who is helping to fund the new renovations?
Everybody. It's really been this remarkable group. Certainly all the major corporations at this point have made significant contributions, great foundation support, and then individuals. It's this wonderful mix of people that understand that what we do is important, that history is important, that having a conversation about the future is important, and that downtown, it's about downtown. And while, when most people say downtown, they think the business district, there's more to downtown.
Oh, yeah.
And there's Broad Street, and we're part of, while it is a stretch, we are part of the city's arts district that really encompasses us all the way down to where the new ICA will be.
Right.
So you've got this cultural corridor that is really an important part of what this part of the city will become over the next decade. And we can already see some of those things happening.
Well, we've been talking with Bill Martin, the director of the Valentine Richmond History Center. The Valentine's latest exhibit, History, Inc., runs until March. March, right?
March.
Yeah.
End of.
And you can see a photo exhibit of the Tattoo Archive Project by going to richmondhistorycenter.com. Thanks for coming, Bill.
Thanks so much.
Broadcast of WIR is made possible in part by VCU Arts, a nationally ranked program featuring 16 visual, design, and performing arts departments, and a campus in Qatar, arts.vcu.edu. WIR's programming is generously supported by the Richmond office of the law firm of Kaufman & Knowles. Kaufman & Knowles, Richmond lawyers serving the needs of Richmond business. For further information, 804-771-5715 or www.kaufmanandknowles.com.
Just 3 years ago, the Richmond Department of Social Services was a busy place, filing more than 280 abuse and neglect petitions with the court seeking to remove children from allegedly dangerous conditions at home. In just 3 years, and with less than a month left in 2012, that number is down to just over 60 petitions, a decrease of nearly 90%. The state of Virginia has stated the intention to see more children remain in their homes, preferring remediation to breaking up families because studies show better long-term outcome for children. But the city's effort to see through on the state's expressed desire has been a remarkable achievement among localities. Sometimes, when something seems too good to be true, it might be too good to be true. Late last month, the state began an investigation into the Richmond Department of Social Services, initiated at the request of Mayor Dwight C. Jones. That investigation and its fallout has quickly ballooned in scope over the past week since it was first reported by WTVR Channel 6 investigative reporter Katie Beck.
All right, I'm with Katie Beck, the News Channel 6 reporter who broke this story. Katie, can you tell us a little bit about what's going on right now with what you found?
Well, I think this week has been a really interesting week for Richmond City leaders and for the mayor because there are a lot of close examinations going on of the Department of Social Services, and this all sort of started anecdotally. It started with a physician reaching out to Councilman Chris Hilbert and saying that she felt there have been too many cases of abused children being returned to abusive homes instead of having other action taken to remove them or put them into foster care. And I guess the anecdotes that Hilbert heard, he characterized as disturbing and horrific, and he was so moved by this that he immediately contacted Mayor Dwight Jones, who responded very quickly and, as I'm told, went to Councilman Hilbert's home and heard these allegations. It was then that sort of the wheels started to turn and the state was called, and other various city leaders were sort of hearing some of the same allegations from workers at DSS that had sent letters. So there was sort of Chris Hilbert and Charles Samuels were sort of the two that were reached out to by these folks, and they, in a combined effort, have brought their findings to the mayor, who has, you know, responded quickly and has not backed away from the fact that this is on the radar.
Now, there was one doctor with an initial claim or allegation, mm-hmm. but there are other cases, and some of these are fairly specific?
There are other cases. Several of them are specific. A lot of this is protected by juvenile records and HIPAA, but when I have some sources who are social workers and caseworkers who have talked to me about the anecdotes that they've relayed to council people and the things that they've seen. And, you know, they involve life-threatening situations with children. And I think that's why you're seeing the city respond with such quick action on this, because it's not really a light issue. I mean, you're talking about safety of children, you're talking about the lives of children, you're talking about the agency that's tasked with protecting abused children. And so, you know, to sort of brush these allegations aside, you know, would not be a wise decision for anyone.
Now, in your reports, you've really truly found some disturbing things that are going on. City Councilman Samuels and Chris Hilbert both have expressed some concerns over what's going on, and the mayor's office has held fast in not expressing any particular support for social services in this case. Do you expect to see, or is there any expectation of that there may be some change in leadership?
I think that's certainly something that's on the table. I think, you know, when you have allegations from employees that involve such serious things, and some of these allegations are directed to leadership-specific issues, you know, tampering with cases and making decisions that are questionable. So those allegations were written down in letters and really specifically address leadership concerns. So I know that the mayor and city council members have seen those letters. They are not ignorant to the fact that the leadership is something that a lot of these anonymous letters focus on. So I think that that's a strong possibility that they are considering, among many other things they're thinking about right now.
The name of the head of social services, please refresh my memory.
The head of social services is, Doris Mosley is the director. Underneath her would be Gail Turner.
Okay.
The one who oversees all of that is Carolyn Graham, the deputy of Byron Marshall.
Now, some of these individuals came here with Graham when she arrived as a deputy CAO, mm-hmm. And had some past history up in the D.C. area where I think some of them were removed from the leadership positions they had there. It's interesting that they ended up coming here recycled to Richmond. Has anybody spoken about that at all, or is that?
I've not heard any city leaders mention the employment histories as part of this investigation. I think they're focused on the now. I think that Dr. Carolyn Graham's involvement with the Juvenile Justice Center is certainly a more recent history that is probably getting factored in here, too. That center was shut down for a year and the children removed from it after she was tasked with sort of turning that boat around.
And that boat was, in fact, very much not turned around.
Right. And that was, you know, that was under her leadership. So I think that they're probably focused on the things that have happened here in Richmond. I do know that they're aware of those past employment histories.
Okay. So where, if anywhere, does the case go at this point? Not case, but I guess the reporting go at this point. Where do you?
Well, they've called for the Child Welfare League of America to come in and do an in-depth audit of Richmond Social Services. This is an independent agency that operates out of Washington, D.C., and they've done similar audits in the past and I'm told have considerable resources to be able to really, you know, do staff interviews and find out morale issues and staffing problems as well as some other more serious
now
allegations.
Who's brought this organization in? Is this the state that has asked for this?
The state, yes. The state made the recommendation. The mayor agreed with it. The state did sort of a shallow preliminary review of some of the cases that were referenced by the councilman.
And determined that there was reason to proceed, or is it just...
I think they found no emergency need for action to go in, but they basically said, we think an independent agency is better suited to do this kind of review, and recommended this specific one that they've used also in the Virginia Beach Social Services Department. That audit took 5 months, so I don't know if that's any indication about how long this one's going to take. But yes, they recommended to the mayor that they call in this group.
Now, the initial issue here was... maybe to some extent exacerbated by some decisions by the state and I believe some federal suggestions of how social services should deal with children and removing them from their homes. And that seems to be playing into some of this. Is any of that being questioned now?
I think it's certainly the bigger picture on this story. It's much bigger picture than Richmond, what we're looking at right here. And
I've heard of cases, too, in other jurisdictions locally. I've just anecdotal over
sure.
months.
Sure. This is a statewide effort to reduce foster care numbers. And it's based on research that suggests that removing a child is... from a home, from their biological parent, is actually in the long run more traumatic than leaving them in the home and sort of dealing with the abuse or the abuser through therapy or, you know, wraparound services. So, you know, instead of removing that kid and putting it in foster care, let's leave it with the parent, but let's make the parent go to counseling. Let's sort of address the abuse.
Yeah, and I've heard of cases, and these are anecdotal stories, but there are cases where a child who was raped by a father still is in the home with the father and was, you know, apologized to by the parent, but is still living with their abuser, as you said.
Right.
So some of these decisions are. Things that a lot of people would be shocked by.
I agree. And whenever I sort of start to explain the theory, which is like I said, a statewide theory that was, you know, put into place and has now been, you know, exacted through social services departments really statewide, people seem to cringe as I'm describing it because it's a concept that doesn't sit well with people immediately. The leaders that I've talked to at state social services tell me that they don't have... they're just now getting back the research to see if this model is really working and if what they think is true, which they hope is true, that kids are safer because of it.
So there was some experimentation in this.
It's fairly new. Yeah, and it started out as sort of a pilot program, and then it's gone throughout the state. Richmond was one of the first to try it. And Richmond does have one of the largest social services departments in the state. It is controversial. It is, you know, one of those things that this doctor who was sort of the whistleblower at the beginning of this said, you know, I've seen this child, you know, over 20 times, and I don't understand why it's not with another guardian. I don't understand why it's still here. So those are the anecdotes that you hear, and it seems that philosophy is controversial. I mean, it does cause people to sort of pause and say, wait, is that, you know, and you know, but from their research and the research that they can provide, you know, it seems that the children have better outcomes when they stay connected with their biological parent versus going into foster care. So there are two sides to it.
And here, it seems like the issue comes down to the leadership. The person who is ultimately making the decision that this case is perhaps too severe and the child does need to come out of the home versus, okay, this is a case where we can, even though to an outsider this may seem extreme, we can implement this idea and perhaps come out with a better outcome.
Right. I think this particular agency, Richmond, you know, they have a 17% vacancy right now. And, you know, there's questions about that. I mean, city council members have been calling on Gail Turner, who is in the agency, to come and sort of defend on a monthly basis before the Human Services Committee why that vacancy.
Almost 20% of the staff just is not there.
Right, right. And so, you know, there's that. There's the numbers of petitions that have dropped since 2009. There were 300 petitions for protective orders or removal. Now, as I understand it, in 2012, there have been 60 this year. You know, that's over an 80% decrease in a three-year time period.
And these are just the requests to remove a child from
right,
the home.
Petitions, right. And you know, and a social service worker pointed out to me, sometimes it never gets to that. They get mediation, they solve the issue, it doesn't go that direction. But, and obviously, this doesn't encapsulate everything, these numbers. But you do, when you see something drop 89% in 3 years, that's more than a sort of a trying out of a philosophy. You know, that's a strong mission-driven process.
Does it look that way elsewhere in the state?
There are decreases across the state. Yeah, absolutely. Foster care numbers are declining statewide. 89% is larger than most.
Okay.
Yeah, by good margin.
And it's a very high margin.
Yeah.
89%.
Yeah. And you know, obviously I haven't looked at every single jurisdiction in the state, you know, but the surrounding areas, you know, the decline is clear, and it's clearly, you know,
a mission.
A mission, sure. Yeah.
All right. I'm here with Katie Beck. She's a reporter with Channel 6, and she has broken the story of both alleged perhaps mismanagement and maybe just endangerment of children that are in the care of City of Richmond's Child Protective Services. Thank you, Katie, for being here.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
What's next for the story, real quick, just to ask?
Well, today I learned that Councilman Charles Samuel sent an email to all employees of the city yesterday urging them, reminding them that there will be no punishment for people who report abuses, fraud, mismanagement, abuse of authority, that these things can go anonymously to the city auditor. And when I questioned Councilman Samuels about this, he said that this was a direct response to the DSS investigation, that he wanted social workers to feel comfortable and protected coming forward if they had other allegations.
So today, Friday, will you be reporting something new?
I suspect I will. I suspect there'll be more developments in the story. And, you know, I think this is going to be a story for a long time. I don't think this is a week or a 2 week thing. I think that there is going to be significant movement.
Sounds far reaching and broad. Thank you again for being here, and we'll listen to your report tonight if there is one, and certainly in the weeks coming.
Thank you.
And that's our show for Friday, December 7th, 2012. I'm co-producer Gabby Schatzi, and our hosts have been Amy Daniel, Chris Dovey, Don Harrison, and Mike McKenzie. My co-producer is Jay Westerman, and our board op is Rachel Solomon. Did you know we have a brand new open source RVA website? Check it out at rvaopensource.com. And if you have a news tip or a love note you'd like to throw our way, send it to us at opensourcerva@gmail.com. And don't forget, people are people too. We'll speak at you next week on Richmond's Audio News Digest, Open Source RVA.